there are just some fundamental geographic reasons that make it more difficult to operate in the U.S. Arctic.
A new report says Arctic shipping isn't likely to increase. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, May 7th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, preparing for wildfire season in Alaska.
We've had kind of unseasonably dry weather, so definitely the fire danger is there.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
As the ice retreats in the Arctic, many people predict more ships will be drawn through the Bering Straits to take advantage of a shortcut between Asia and Europe. But as APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, a recent government report suggests less ice may not mean more ships.
Senator Lisa Murkowski has made it her mission to remind Washington the Arctic is opening up. In speeches and at hearings with top officials, she aims to instill a sense of urgency about preparing for an increase in ship traffic and new economic opportunities. Here's Murkowski last month on the Senate floor.
The time to develop the infrastructure and support capacity to handle this growing amount of traffic is now. Actually, it was yesterday.
A recent report from the Government Accountability Office runs counter to her message. The report authors interviewed dozens of stakeholders, including executives at cargo companies, mining companies, and cruise lines, about their plans to send more ships into the Arctic.
We came to the conclusion that it was going to be limited.
That's Lorelei St. James, team leader on the GAO report. Two big caveats: the GAO looked only at commercial activity in the American Arctic and only over the next decade. But St. James found that just because ships can traverse the Arctic for part of the year doesn't mean they will.
There are just some fundamental geographic reasons that make it more difficult to operate in the U.S. Arctic.
While an over-the-top route can be 40% shorter than the traditional voyage between Asia and Europe, the GAO found container shipping companies aren't interested. To them, speed is less important than reliability. The business is largely driven by the need for components to move steadily around the globe, from factories to assembly plants to markets. Nobody wants inventory to pile up, so if ships are late, St. James says, a factory might have to halt production.
They're very concerned about on time, and with the unpredictability of some of the weather patterns up there, it just made the shipping companies that we talked to less, the U.S. Arctic less attractive to them.
Time is also a big factor for cruise lines in the Arctic, the GAO learned.
We were told that even if there were deep water ports or ports that the cruises could stop at, that it just takes so long to go through the U.S. Arctic that there's just a lack of demand from the mainstream for that type of cruise.
The Arctic lacks deep water ports, and the U.S. has only two working icebreakers. But better maritime infrastructure would not really boost shipping or tourism, St. James says, although miners told the GAO they could use a new dock.
Right now, the zinc that their Red Dog mine has is lighter than copper, so the copper industry would need a deeper water port. But officials told us that they were not prepared to pay for that type of infrastructure.
Admiral Thomas Ostebo, commander of the Coast Guard in Alaska, says he agrees with the GAO report and the cautionary note it strikes on building maritime infrastructure.
Based on what we know now and the uncertainty in the future and the indications today from industry, it's too early to tell what infrastructure we need, where we would need it, and how big that should be.
Get those answers wrong and you waste a lot of money. Ostabo says the perceived need for more icebreakers goes up and down, but the Coast Guard is in the very early stages of possibly acquiring a new one. Meanwhile, though, Ostabo says the clearest need in Arctic waters is for things like better maps and charts, improved communication technology, and new environmental surveys.
There is a future for the Arctic, and those things would be great investments into whatever future come up.
Senator Murkowski says she appreciates the GAO report's emphasis on the need for mapping and charting, but maintains Arctic activity is on the rise, so now is the time to invest there. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
The U.S. Coast Guard has operated in the Arctic for more than a century, but as the Maritime Agency plans for an increased presence in the region, it's taking stock of what its environmental impact will be in the Arctic in the years to come. KNOM's Matthew Smith reports.
The U.S. Coast Guard has been operating in the Arctic for over a century, but as the Maritime Agency plans for an increased presence in the region, it's taking stock of what its environmental impact will be in the Arctic in the years to come. Mike Dombowski is on the team drafting the Coast Guard's new environmental assessment for Alaska's District 17, which was released yesterday. The document looks at what increased training and patrols in the Bering, Chukchi, and Beaufort Seas will mean for Arctic ecosystems.
What you might call day-to-day Coast Guard operations, doing patrols, search and rescue, aids to navigation, the other types of missions that we perform. Here's what we would see ourselves doing, and here's what we think the environmental impacts of those things are.
The assessment looks at the Coast Guard's plans for its broader Arctic presence from mid-March through mid-November in the years to come. Beyond summer training exercises in the region, exercises that the service has already conducted for several years running, the increased Arctic operations call for establishing safety zones around vessels exploring for oil, enforcing laws protecting endangered species and marine mammals, and poaching prevention of fish stocks and mineral deposits. The plan also calls for routine patrols of Arctic waters with the nation's two active icebreakers. Overall, the new assessment claims that the Coast Guard's impact on the Arctic will be minimal and finds an increased Coast Guard presence will have, quote, no significant adverse impacts on water quality, Arctic biology, cultural resources, and public safety. Even if their Arctic commitments increase, the bigger question for the Coast Guard may be one of resources. Andrew Hartzig directs the Arctic program at the Ocean Conservancy, a nonprofit ocean advocacy group in Anchorage. He says an increased Coast Guard presence above the Arctic Circle is, on the whole, a good thing for the region, but he questions if the agency has what it needs to carry out its goals.
The limiting factor is clearly funding. Until the Coast Guard gets more funding specifically to engage in Arctic work, they're going to be resource limited in terms of the personnel and assets that they can bring to bear.
Despite continued calls from residents and organizations in the Arctic for plans and preparation for maritime disasters like an oil spill in Arctic waters, Dombowski says those are all questions for a different assessment to answer.
Oil spill response is such a huge, big enough thing that it really deserves its own document, and that document and supporting stuff is being done right now.
For now, the Coast Guard plans to tour its new environmental assessment statewide, with plans to visit Anchorage, Kotzebue, Nome, and Barrow in the coming weeks. In Nome, I'm Matthew Smith.
While the rest of the state is gearing up for wildfire season, Unalaska's emergency responders spent the day fighting an industrial fire inside a local longshore warehouse. As KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports, the building appears to be a total loss.
Uber Souza is a dock worker for Pacific Stevedoring. At 5 a.m. Wednesday, he was at home in a dormitory right next door to the warehouse that his company leases from the Unalaska Corporation. Suddenly, Souza says,
"Someone woke me up. I was sleeping. Because the police came knocking on everybody's door to get out. So everybody had to get out. We didn't have time to get anything."
The warehouse was on fire and smoke was blowing through Souza's bunk. Souza says he and about 20 other people made it out safely. Meanwhile, emergency personnel and volunteers from the State Department of Transportation started fighting the blaze. They blocked off the road around the warehouse and began pumping water inside. After 11 hours, the building was still on fire, but also still standing. City workers used an excavator to peel away the charred aluminum siding and allow firefighters better access. Steam and smoke billowed out of the structure, but the fire stayed contained. Fire Chief Abner Hoag says the warehouse was full of basic but highly flammable materials. There may have been tar-coated fishing nets.
It was reported that there were about 20 pallets of wax-coated fiber board in there, as well as a whole bunch of empty pallets. And of course, that stuff burns really hot and really long.
A little over a decade ago, a fire ripped through another structure in the same location as this warehouse. It contained the same kind of materials, pallets and fiberboard. Hoag says that fire took 3 days to extinguish.
So it could be a while getting everything completely out to where it's safe for us to go in and evaluate what happened.
Hoag says that firefighters will stay on site as long as it takes, but at this point, it doesn't look like there's anything left to salvage. Hoag estimates that between $1.5 and $2.5 million worth of damage has been done, including the value of the physical structure and the equipment stored in it. That's a big enough loss to trigger an investigation by the state fire marshal. They're expected to arrive in Onalaska Thursday to determine what caused the fire. The Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation is also involved in the case. Onalaska's fire department used chemical foam to smother the flames Wednesday morning. Some of that foam leaked out of the building and onto the beach about 100 yards away. Fire Chief Hoag says they stopped using the foam and let the DEC know about the possible contamination.
DEC sent a local rep out to take some pictures of the foam in the water, and you can see a lot of that's dissipated. And the Anchorage office has been notified.
Managers for Pacific Stevedoring, which was renting out the warehouse, and the Unalashka Corporation, which owns it, are cooperating with the investigation, but neither company could be reached for comment. And on Alaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, playing video games on purpose in school.
I was actually just sitting over there and I saw somebody playing Minecraft and I was like, is somebody slacking off in class? And I came over here and everybody had Minecraft open.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you're ready to quit tobacco or just thinking about it, the coaches at Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line, a free service for all Alaska adults, can support you with Text to Quit, with tools to make your quit attempt successful. Text to Quit helps you stay in touch with your quit coach, use nicotine replacement medications properly, manage those urges to use tobacco, and prevent relapses, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
A commercial airliner delivered the United States honor flag to Fairbanks yesterday. The flag, which flew at Ground Zero in New York following the September 11th terrorist attacks and has since traveled around the country to honor fallen law enforcement officers and firefighters, was brought to Fairbanks to honor to pay tribute to Alaska State Trooper Sergeant Patrick Scott Johnson and Trooper Gabe Rich, who were killed in Tanana last week. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
An Alaska Airlines plane carrying the U.S. Honor flag taxied through an arch of spray from water cannons before coming to a stop at Fairbanks International Airport. It's part of a receiving ceremony repeated across the country to honor law enforcement officers or firefighters who die in the line of duty. The folded honor flag was then carried off the plane through a formation made up of the fallen state troopers' families, fellow troopers, and other law enforcement officers and firefighters who lined the tarmac. Alaska Honor Flag liaison Anchorage firefighter Brian Lay escorted the flag to Fairbanks.
It really shows that there's attention to this on a national scale and that there's thoughts and prayers and support coming for the families to really give that honor to let them know that the entire nation's behind them and thinking about them.
The honor flag will be on display at a funeral service for Sergeant Patrick Scott Johnson and Trooper Gabe Rich to be held Saturday afternoon at the Carlson Center in Fairbanks. Sets of special gloves used to handle the honor flag in Fairbanks will be placed in the caskets and given to their families. Lay says the honor flag organization is based in Florida, but the flag is most always deployed to communities across the country. This is the honor flag's fourth trip to Alaska and first to Fairbanks. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska State Troopers are maintaining a presence in the village of Tanana. Trooper spokeswoman Megan Peters says troopers do not have a post in the village, and the assignment of officers there is temporary.
Since the incident, we have had 2 to 3 troopers in Tanana. We've also had 1 to 2 VPSOs. Really, they are there to help reassure the community and also to support the VPSO program during this difficult time.
Peter says troopers have been focused on positive outreach in Tanana, including playing basketball with local kids. The sunshine and warmer weather are bringing more Alaskans out to enjoy parks and trails, but that increase in recreation can also mean more accidental fires. Four agencies joined forces at a media event yesterday to get the word out about fire prevention. APRN intern Jolene Almendarez has the story.
Jonathan Glover is standing in a light jacket in an on-again, off-again drizzle in South Anchorage. But the wildfire technician with the Division of Forestry says don't be fooled by the spring shower. Alaskans could still be in for a warm and dry summer, ripe with chances for wildland fires.
When we get rain like this, it doesn't really take long once the sun comes out, an hour or two, and the fine fuels, the grasses and stuff are starting to dry out. So you still have a relatively high risk of fire. It's been fairly dry in the month of April and May. We've had kind of unseasonably dry weather, so definitely the fire danger's there.
Sue Rodman is program coordinator with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. She says a lot of fire safety tips are just a matter of being aware of one's surroundings and knowing basic prevention techniques, especially when it comes to your own home.
You need to pay attention to things that burn and the things that are next to your house. So if it's combustible and it's next to your house, move it. If it's a piece of firewood, move it, or if it's dry, dry grass.
She says campers need to be mindful of fire conditions and obey the laws and regulations for the land they're using. Rodman also acknowledges the need for naturally occurring fires in more remote locations.
It's really important to keep our moose habitat and our moose populations healthy, as well as other populations. There's bird species and other smaller mammals that need different stages of the forest to survive. So that's why we have to remember fire's not always bad, but we want to make sure that we're using it appropriately to protect infrastructure and people.
While fires aren't predictable, Jonathan Glover says combining preventative efforts and practicing emergency readiness is key to keeping people safe and structures undamaged.
If you see a wildland fire, if you think that you might be having something that's escaping your control or getting out of hand, just call right away for help. We'd much rather come out and assist something small than let something grow into something that's unmanageable.
Sue Rodman says the city is prepared with ground and air crews to fight wildfires, but it's essential for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, Alaska Division of Forestry, Bureau of Land Management, and Anchorage Fire Department to work together to plan for fire emergencies to efficiently use resources. In Anchorage, I'm Jolene Almendarez.
The Anchorage NAACP and the Anchorage Central Labor Council have called on Lieutenant Governor candidate Dan Sullivan to apologize for comments likening required payment of union dues to slavery. Sullivan, who currently serves as Anchorage mayor, made the comments during a candidate forum on Monday. The slavery comparison came up when Sullivan was asked about right-to-work legislation in which employees are not required to join a union to get or keep a job. Sullivan told the Associated Press today that there are many forms of slavery, and he was talking about economic slavery. While he originally said he did not believe an apology was necessary, he later sent a statement saying that he apologized, quote, if the use of the word offended anyone.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Share your culture and create lifelong connections by welcoming an AFS International Exchange student from one of 90 countries into your home. Information at 1-800-AFS-INFO. This message sponsored by AFS USA. Salmon aren't just another fish in Alaska. They're our lifeblood, a source of food, rich tradition, jobs, businesses, and community. They're as resilient as Alaskans themselves and as creative and resourceful, too. At salmonlove.com, you'll find a site dedicated to Alaskans' connection with our state's most famed fish. Enjoy stories, tips, fun, and lots of other salmon-y goodness, too. SalmonLove.com. This message brought to you by the Salmon Project.
Ground was broken yesterday for the first new school to be constructed in more than a decade in the Matanuska-Susitna Borough. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, the new Joe Reddington Senior School is located near the original homestead of the father of the Iditarod.
A spring downpour did nothing to dampen the spirit of the day. Matanuska-Susitna Borough Mayor Larry DeVilbiss, wearing a hard hat, stood with other state and borough officials and school district leaders to work gold-painted shovels into the dirt for the ceremonial first dig at the construction site.
This is the first
major school project in 10 years. And this is a complex that includes high school, middle, and elementary school. So it's a big step out into the future towards where our growing center is.
DeVilbiss says the school project is keeping up with the growth in the area. He says if Kinnick Fairview Incorporated, it would be the fifth largest city in the state. The new Joe Reddington Senior, Junior Senior High School will house some 550 students as soon as the doors open in the fall of next year. Catherine Essery, spokeswoman for the Mat-Su School District, says it will be a junior-senior high school to begin with and then convert to a high school.
Actually, we have enough students out here to fill it when we open it. It will be full because we'll be bringing kids from Wasilla Middle and High School. We have 20 portables there now. So this will help decrease that crowding. And also we have two elementary feeder schools already at Kinnick and Goose Bay. They house 400 and 450 students, so we already have 800 kids ready to come. You know, these are not built out for the future. These are just-in-time construction projects, which we thank our voters for.
The $65 million project is being paid for out of a bond package that borough voters approved in 2011. Barbara Reddington, Ramey Reddington's wife and daughter-in-law of Joe, says she's proud the school is named after him.
It's such a great honor for Joe and for Vi. What an honor for Joe, especially in the Kinnick area where he homesteaded. He homesteaded here to Kinnick in 1948.
Despite the congestion along Kinnick Goose Bay Road, the school's location about a mile off the highway is quiet and surrounded by forest. Construction machinery droned in the background during the event. Bulldozers were still leveling the recently cleared 103 acres for the project. Mike Brown with the borough's Capital Projects Department says the plan calls for a second school to be built on the site after the new building is complete. The two schools will address overcrowding in borough schools. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The popular video game Minecraft has made its way into Juneau High School classrooms. A course at the University of Alaska Southeast showed teachers how to implement the game in classes. KTOO's Lisa Fu went to an algebra class to hear what students have to say about Minecraft, not as a game, but as a learning tool.
It's fourth period at Juneau Douglas High School. Lexi Razor's ninth grade Algebra 1 class is using the library computers. Minecraft is on the screens.
Everybody should be in the building, and you need to go to the different structures and start calculating the volume and the surface area.
The class is part of Choice, an alternative learning program for students needing extra support in order to graduate. 15-year-old Mackenzie Bittinger is working with a classmate on the assignment.
3 by 5, 3 by 6. 1, 2, 3.
They're working on finding surface area and volume of different shapes. But Mackenzie is more excited to talk about a different Minecraft project, building a 3D model of a plant cell. She says the model included all the different parts of a cell.
There's the chloroplast and the mitochondria. And what was the other one? Chlorophyll?
Mackenzie most enjoys collaborating with other students.
You learn from each other, and you learn other people's strategies and stuff like that, and it's better to be social, and I think it's a lot more fun. It helps me a lot.
Mackenzie has Minecraft at home, but doesn't find it appealing
to build random things out of pixelated blocks.
But in class, she's a fan.
It's better than doing actual, just writing on paper. I think this is a better way of learning than the usual way. It's fun, and you actually learn from it.
For 15-year-old Evan Ockpick, Minecraft is a way to stay engaged in academic work he often finds boring.
If you weren't playing Minecraft, what do you think you'd be doing now in class?
Probably trying to sleep, listening to music. That's what I do when I hate a class.
3 months ago, teacher Lexi Razor didn't know how to play Minecraft, let alone teach it in class. But after taking a graduate education course at the University of Alaska Southeast, she's happy to have another tool to use in the classroom.
It just helps them to learn how to do things in ways that they're interested in. And so they may put forth more effort and understand it more because it's something that they can relate to.
Razor says the students exhibit academic traits associated with science, technology, engineering, and math, subjects collectively known as STEM.
They just think that they're playing, but when we were doing the project, listening to the groups and how they talked and how they were problem solving and how they needed to fix the things that they built, that's STEM, and they don't even realize that they're doing it, but they're practicing those things.
Razor plans to use Minecraft in her geometry class. She says it's important to connect the game to the curriculum.
I'm trying to come up with some kind of project where I'm going to give them a certain amount of volume and they have to build some structures or do something so that they can use Minecraft, because they've heard that I've been using it and they're pretty jealous.
Toward the end of class, 12th grader Colin McClung walks over to the computer area.
I was actually just sitting over there and I saw somebody playing Minecraft, and I was like, is somebody slacking off in class? And I came over here and everybody had Minecraft open.
McClung says he's happy to see a teacher has realized that video games can be used as teaching tools and aren't just a waste of time. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
50 schools participated in Bike to School Day in Anchorage today. KSKA's Ann Hillman talked to students from Lake Otis Elementary about why they hopped on their bikes instead of into vehicles and what they learned along the way.
Because I live near it, and it's also fun because I get to ride with my friends to school. And then when you're outside, then you get and you're riding your bike to school, then you can just have more fun and you can get more exercise and talk with your friends.
Felt fun. It didn't smell as bad as a bus.
It's fun and you have exercise. But the most important thing is that you stay safe. Stay on the sidewalks and only cross when the little white guy comes on.
Why would you ring a bell on a bike?
So that you can tell anybody who you're gonna pass by that you're behind them and you don't scare them and they fall over or something.
Describe how it felt when you're talking to your friends who didn't bike to school.
Well, it was actually kind of fun when I told them, because they laughed and stuff and they said that was so cool.
Allie. Okay.
Oh, second.
Allie third. Okay, go.
Those were students from Lake Otis Elementary talking about their first experiences biking to school. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Matthew Smith in Nome, Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ellen Lockyer in the Mat-Su Valley, Lisa Fu in Juneau, and Ann Hillman in Anchorage. APRN's Liz Bruskin reported from Washington, D.C., and Jolene Almendarez from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Monica Goki. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. And by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. May is National Bike Safety Month. Alaskans are riding their bikes to school, work, and play. Motorists, be on the lookout for bikes and pedestrians. Bicyclists, follow the rules of the road. All riders should wear a fitted helmet and use reflectors and safety lights to be seen no matter what time of day. Go to injuryprevention.alaska.gov for safety tips. This message sponsored by the Alaska Highway Safety Office and the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.